Good afternoon. Thank you. Today we're going to talk about a little bit of history involving front of package and side of packages, as the case is with tobacco products, labeling, and the tobacco industry, and see if we can learn some lessons that may help inform our way forward dealing with food front of package labeling. So these are cautionary tales from the tobacco industry and tobacco control. And I've have no interests or relationships to report. Would want to acknowledge my boss, of course, Richard Daynard at Northeastern University School of Law, who's the PI of our project, and Andrew Shane and Lori Dorfman from the Berkeley Media Studies Group, and my colleagues Lissy Friedman and Carol Wilking, who have helped us with this work, which is funded by the National Cancer Institute. So what we're going to do is talk a little bit about our study of tobacco industry data, look at some regulatory interactions, which I'm going to characterize as dancing, analyze their effects on warning and front of package tar and nicotine labeling and related marketing, talk about some proactive strategies we may consider, and the relevance for food front of package labeling and public health. So we looked at arguments. What we've been studying are arguments raised by the tobacco industry, public health actors, and policymakers. And we looked at the New York Times and Washington Post news coverage of tobacco. We also looked at the Congressional Record, the Federal Register, and the massive collection, which is available online, of tobacco industry documents that came available through litigation over the last 15 years or so. And so we're going to take you back to 1952, which was the last year that cigarettes could do a happy dance. This is the beginning. Before they could do a happy dance, later they'd have to dance with regulators.
Say, it's not my favorite dancing, so let's go.
These are joyful, simple steps that the packs of cigarettes could do. These were the days.
A treat instead of a treat. That's Old Gold cigarettes. Made by tobacco men, not medicine men.
Made by tobacco men, not medicine men.
Because in every way, it's a better cigarette.
Now this would change dramatically, because later that year in 1952, Reader's Digest published the first set of articles that really brought to the public's attention the emerging science that connected smoking with lung cancer. And that was it was a mid-1952 commercial. By November of 1952, people were very concerned, and there was major news coverage linking smoking to lung cancer in 1952 and 1953, and sales of cigarettes declined dramatically during that time. Late 1953, December, the CEOs of the tobacco companies met at the Plaza Hotel in New York secretly and came up with a strategy to save their floundering industry. And published in a full-page ad in over 700 newspapers in January of 1954 called the Frank Statement to Cigarette Smokers, where they promised they would start a huge research initiative on the safety of their products, because the health of their consumers, their customers, was paramount to all other concerns of their business, quote-unquote. Starting in 1955, shortly thereafter, really, filter tips were emerged, a whole variety of new types of filters on cigarettes. Every new brands were introduced, and old brands were introduced with filter tips, and wild claims about the health benefits of these filter tips were made. And these are essentially product reformulations, similar to what we certainly have seen in food. And this went on through about 1960. And so starting in the mid-1950s, you'll see effective filtration listed on Liggett-Meyer cigarettes. It's the filter that counts. much more flavor, much less nicotine. It's actually in the corner. You can't quite see. It says it's a miracle filter. Viceroy. What have Viceroy's got that other filter cigarettes haven't got? 20,000 filters in every Viceroy tip. Leading New York doctor tells his patients what to smoke and says, in fact, physician tells patients smoke Viceroy filter tip cigarettes. It's the tip that does the trick. And maybe the most infamous of all is listed on the front of the pack is the famous Micronite filter. And the interaction between the marketing here and the front of package is evident all over America. More scientists and educators smoke Kent with the Micronite filter. I don't know if you can see in the graphic the little blue fuzz from this. This is crassidolite asbestos. It's the most deadly form of asbestos that was used in the Micronite filter from 1954 to 1957. It causes invariably fatal mesothelioma. Those were the reformulations between 1955 and 1957. The FTC challenged these health claims and initiated complaints against the companies for unsubstantiated health claims. These took approximately each action took about 2 years to resolve. By the time they were resolved, the brand was gone or the marketing campaign changed, and so it was irrelevant. So Minnesota Congressman John Blatnick decided to hold the first hearings on smoking and health in Congress in 1957, seeing that the FTC wasn't getting anywhere with this. And so they brought the head researchers from the tobacco industry, including Clarence Cook Little, to Congress and asked them questions about what they were doing, what these filter tips were really doing, and he found that in fact the tobacco companies were increasing tar and nicotine in their filtered cigarettes to ensure that their customers were getting an adequate amount of flavor in their cigarettes. There was a report issued by the subcommittee that was very critical of the cigarette companies, and the Blatnick bill resulted, which was a bill to limit tar and nicotine in cigarettes, and that bill was never reached the floor. In fact, it never had a committee assignment. Blatnick was stripped of his committee assignment, and his subcommittee was dissolved. And the tobacco industry formed the Tobacco Institute in response to be its mouthpiece in public relations and dealing with Congress. In 1960, however, the FTC reached a voluntary agreement with the cigarette companies not to compete on health claims and not to mention tar and nicotine in their marketing. So in 1964, of course, that was the big year that the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health was issued. We saw big spikes in news coverage around that, as well as increased activity in Congress and at the FTC. Various states were considering skull and crossbones warnings on packs of cigarettes. And the FTC began a rulemaking process in 1965, and they had a draft of a warning that they were going to place on packs of cigarettes stating cigarette smoking is dangerous to health and may cause death from cancer and other diseases. But Congress came to the rescue of the tobacco companies in 1965, and they passed the Federal Cigarette Labeling and Advertising Act, which would create a single warning system that preempted anything that could happen at the state level, and also stripped the FTC of any warnings that they may be able to put on cigarette packs. And so here are the warnings that resulted. Wait a second. This is wrong. These are actually the 2011 proposed FDA graphic warning labels on the front of packs of cigarettes. They're slightly different from the ones that Congress approved and were on every pack of cigarette beginning in 1966. Actually, this is the side of the pack of cigarettes. And there it is in tiny print: caution, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health. So that's what we ended up with. in 1967 under criticism from the public health community and others that this ban on being able to compete on the basis of health claims was suppressing the development of a safer cigarette and perhaps putting the public at risk. The FTC began developing with in conjunction with the tobacco industry a measurement method to standardize their tar and nicotine ratings. And by 1971, there was a voluntary agreement with the industry for nicotine ratings to that they would all agree to, and the FTC, it became known as the FTC method, although the FTC only played a small role in working with the industry and coming up with the technique. They agreed with the industry to put these tar and nicotine ratings on all tobacco or cigarette advertising. And so you see Marlboro's came out with Marlboro Lights at that time, with 13 milligrams of tar versus Camel Lights that had 9 milligrams of tar. New brands came to the market to compete on this basis. Carlton is the lowest. U.S. government report, because it's the FTC method, seems to indicate that Carlton is a healthier smoke. And Philip Morris comes out with Merits at this time. And this was how this was called the tar derbies, as these light cigarettes came out competing on the basis of tar and nicotine ratings that people thought would be very useful in terms of helping consumers decide. And then in the Surgeon General's report of 1981, Surgeon General said that manufacturers should list yields of tar, nicotine, and other components on their packages. And so some of the brands began to do this beginning in 1982. And you see here True, Larkin, Parliament. If you can see at the bottoms of the pack, 4 milligrams of tar, 8 milligrams of tar for Lark. Parliaments have 5 milligrams of tar. So you can get a sense of how much tar is in your cigarette and how much nicotine you'll get, except that that's not what you're getting out of this from this labeling. What the companies were doing were putting very tiny, almost microscopic holes, vent holes, in the filters. And these vent holes allowed the smoke that was drawn into the machines that measured the tar and nicotine to be diluted with outside air. And see, the very tip of the cigarette is placed inside the inside these machines that measured the tar and nicotine, and air would be drawn in through these holes that were placed on the filters, and that is what determined the tar and nicotine ratings of the brands. When a smoker uses the smokes, they cover these holes with their lips and with their fingers for the most part. So the numbers that were on the fronts of on the packs and in the advertising were almost totally bogus. And that was quite a tricky little dance move that the industry pulled off there for many years, with really horrendous public health consequences, because people who might have been motivated to quit smoking or try to quit smoking instead thought they could switch to a low tar or low nicotine brand of cigarette, and that's not what they were actually getting. And so this dance continues to this day. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, that now has regulatory authority over tobacco products, is considering whether or not to eliminate menthol brand cigarettes, because they are it's easier for youth to start smoking menthol because the menthol anesthetizes the throat and lungs somewhat. And it also seems to be harder for people to quit smoking menthol cigarettes. And menthol cigarettes are marketed especially hard towards African Americans. 80% of African American smokers smoke menthol cigarettes. And as the FDA has been considering this, Lorillard, in its submission to the FDA, spins it a little differently. They say, well, there are 4 million African American menthol smokers, but there were over 8 million white menthol smokers in 2006. I mean, geez, there's no special impact there. And so I was last month I was flying to the American Cancer Society in Atlanta for a meeting, and in the seat pocket in front of me there was a Jet magazine, and this very Jet magazine, as a matter of fact. And so I wondered if there was a Newport ad in it, and of course there was. And this was the ad, Newport Pleasure, in Jet magazine. And I was looking at it, and I saw this, as you can see, I circled in red here, something that I hadn't seen before in Newport ads. And then I actually, when I got back home, I tried to look at it with my reading glasses and then a magnifying glass to figure out what the heck that thing said, and I couldn't tell. But when I got back to my office, we had a pack of Newports there for scholarly purposes, I can assure you. And it said on the side of the pack, these cigarettes do not present a reduced risk of harm compared to other cigarettes. And this is a voluntary labeling statement that Lorillard is placing on their packs of cigarettes in order to act as a shield for FDA regulation, and also in the products liability context, where they've come under enormous pressure. There was a $100-something million verdict about a year ago in Boston on a case like this. So let me go over quickly the steps of the dance, because I'm running out of time. First, you have health concerns over the product, and then the industry responds with reformulations, wild unsubstantiated claims, including front of package. Then you have a threat of a regulatory response and an offer to self-regulate, or perhaps later a voluntary agreement with regulators to appease them for a while. Maybe there's a consumer warning initiative, and that is likely to be weakened by the political strength of the industry. Regulators urge companies to do more, so maybe more front-of-package labeling is used to sell and mislead consumers. Regulators and legal actions move forward, and then the package labeling could be used, as we just saw with these Newports, to shield regulation and liability. So I think the key question on front-of-package, on this front-of-package regulatory dance is who leads and who follows. And I'm going to give you four ways to lead the dance. Number one, of course, agency-initiated, evidence-based front-of-package initiatives centered on the public health impact is key. So hopefully you get that. Sometimes it's hard to get that. So when you get something that's less than that, evidence-based opposition to industry-initiated self-regulation or voluntary agreements, where FOP for front-of-package labeling initiatives needs to be done very strongly. We can't let it just happen and then you're stuck with a deceptive system. Three, the public health community can initiate agency petitions for evidence-based front-of-package labeling. When you don't have an agency that's willing to do it or has the political will to move forward, sometimes citizens' petitions led by public health groups can give them that push to move forward. And then finally, legal actions to create liability to stop false and misleading front-of-package labeling practices by industry can help jumpstart regulators as well. So those are my four ways to lead the dance. Hope it was these are helpful, and I'll leave you with our happy dance. Once again, Dennis James, lung cancer victim. Thank you very much.